Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm a little disoriented this evening. How about you?
I hope we haven't disoriented our audience too bad. We're 1 hour later than we normally are. And
yeah,
that's to accommodate
our
great
guests. We
don't
like doing that unintentionally. We like to disorient them intentionally, but not unintentionally. So I do want to apologize for any confusion anyone had about what time the show was starting. Normally I blame Blog Talk Radio for everything, and I could plausibly do that this time out, but it actually was my mistake. We had moved the show to a later time, and I failed to update that on the Blog Talk Radio site. So some people were getting a warning that the show was about to start or that the host hadn't called in. And I apologize for that, but I'm glad to see that we've got folks listening in the chat room, and that we've straightened it out, and that here we are doing our program, so that feels pretty good.
Yeah, we even got Sally in the chat room and a couple others too, so I'm excited.
All right, well it's going to be a good show, and we're going to be talking about a subject that is very near and dear to our hearts, and that subject is the moon, and we're going to be talking specifically about the possibility of a moon settlement, a permanent moon colony. And to join us talking about that, we're pleased to welcome two guests this evening. The first one I'll introduce now, and the second one will be joining us just a little bit later. But our first guest is Rand Sinberg. Rand is an expert on space technology and policy, particularly with regard to NASA and commercial human spaceflight. He's published lengthy essays on these topics at the New Atlantis and done many columns for Fox News, Popular Mechanics, AOL News, and Pajamas Media. Of course, you can also find his blog over at Transterrestrial Musings. Rand, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you. I'm disoriented too, but that's my normal state, so I'm good.
Okay, good. Well, so we're all kind of on the same page here. I appreciate you coming on the show this evening and talking about moon settlement. Before we do, you reminded me of something via email that I think we want to touch on this evening, which is that today is a significant anniversary in the history of human space travel, isn't it?
Well, I don't know what's significant or not. You know, we have this arbitrary thing and say, well, if it's 10 years, then it's significant. If it's 9, it's not as big a deal. But, you know, I mean, so it's only 9, so is that not significant? Point is, it's the 9th anniversary of the loss of Columbia. And I wrote, I had a piece at Pajamas Media today about that said, you know, gee, there are a lot of people there thought, well, we're going to see a big change in space policy. But in the end, it turned out to be not so big a change in space policy. In fact, we're worse off now than we were then. So you have to go read the piece, I guess, to understand all that, because I don't know how much time we want to spend on that. But
we'll put a link to that piece up in the chat room. Make sure we add that on the show notes. And absolutely, this is the anniversary. I couldn't believe it when you told me. It was like the, I mean, not that it was today, but that 9 years have gone.
9 years ago. And it's 20. It was, you know, Saturday was 26 years since Challenger.
Uh huh. And Sunday, I guess, then would have been the 45th anniversary of Apollo 1.
No, that was Friday.
Oh, excuse me.
But that's okay. But point is, yes, it's been
I got
45
my dates backwards. But this is that cluster of dates during the year when we remember. When we remember those who have on the American
right.
side, who
which
have
NASA
died
actually
in...
has, yeah, NASA has actually set aside the last Thursday of January to remember all that stuff because they all come so close to each other.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a very sad confluence. And Stephen, I thought it would be appropriate tonight. We'll just dedicate our program in memory of those who have lost their lives in space exploration. Along those lines, we would also remember there have been some cosmonauts as well. The dates don't cluster, but Soyuz 1 and lost one astronaut, or excuse me, cosmonaut, and Soyuz 11, all three cosmonauts on that flight. And I was looking this up.
It's an important point in the context of our discussion tonight, because we make such a big effing deal, pardon my French, about when we lose astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'm actually working on a major paper and a symposium on this subject. And Bob Zubrin, you know, love him or hate him, and you know, I have mixed feelings. Had a piece in the most recent Reason magazine about how irrational we are about astronaut safety. That we spend so much money to make sure that nobody ever dies going into space, even though it doesn't do any good. We spent billions of dollars to keep it from happening, and it still happens. You know, we lost 17 people, just the three NASA incidents we just discussed.
Yep.
And somehow we have this weird fantasy that we're going to open up the harshest frontier ever without losing people, and it's keeping us from doing it.
It's built in. You know, I've been reading it. Rand, have you by any chance read the book Rocket Men? It's a kind of a history of really the entire Apollo program, but specifically gets into the details of Apollo 11. And one of the things that is discussed in that book is that the risks that we were willing to take then, we're not willing to take now.
Yes,
we're not willing to take anything like them.
We absolutely, you know, Apollo 8 was what won the space race. People think it happened when we landed on the moon, but no. It was when we sent those guys around the moon in 1968, and they took the pictures of the Earth and the created Earth Day and all the disaster that was the environmental movement and all that stuff. That was when we won the Earth. And NASA could absolutely not do that mission today. It would not happen because it would be too risky. It was very risky at the time, but they were willing to take the risk because they were doing something important. They were trying to beat the Soviets to the moon, and they were afraid that the Soviets were going to beat them around the moon because there were very real concerns that, you know, we know they don't have the stuff to land on the moon, but they could beat us around the moon. It would be one more victory in the space race for the Soviets if they do that. So they took the risk, even though there had only been the first Saturn flight had been a disaster, and then there were two successful ones, and they decided, let's roll the dice and send guys around the moon in December of 68, because they didn't have the LEM ready yet, so they couldn't do a landing.
Well,
there was no way today's NASA could do that, because what we're doing today is not important.
Hmm.
Well, let's bring Brian Wong into the conversation. Brian, what's your thoughts? Could we do what the Apollo program did then, today, in our climate, in our current climate?
I think Robert Zubrin was writing about how recent decisions with the space program value the life of an astronaut at about $1 billion when they.
It's not a billion. They put an infinite value on it.
Right. Infinite. Well, yeah.
They won't even sign a number.
Yeah. So, and basically, the craziness of all that is that if the astronaut is driving on the highway going to NASA, he's worth about $5 million, according to the Highway Administration. If he's buying something at the store, he's worth about $5 million to the consumer protection. You know, if he's going through the environment, about, $5 million, $8 million. But then once he steps onto the rocket, suddenly he's worth a billion or infinite amount of money. And so all the decisions get distorted because of that, that you're not willing to do things because you don't want to throw the lives away, but you're overly concerned about them compared to other people. You're not worried about the mission and trying to do do important things. And I would say that, you know, just like when the soldiers are doing things, you know, the mission is the most important thing. They should be concerned about the mission. And if you're saying that the mission's not worth the astronaut's life, then why are you funding it in the first place?
That's you know, that really goes to the difference. It's that view of the of what was at stake in carrying out that mission at that time versus what is perceived to be at stake now. What is the purpose of manned spaceflight taking place at all now versus then? Right? It was a completely different. Completely different attitude. Well, you think about it. I mean, today they would say that an astronaut's life is worth a billion or infinitely valuable, or however they do that. Very interesting math. We know that there were contingency plans built into Apollo 11 around the LEM not being able to take off from the moon. Right? Nixon had a speech he was going to deliver. A lot of us have seen that on the web and elsewhere. I mean, the fact that people could die in the process was built into the thinking. I mean, they didn't want it to happen. They were obviously trying to avoid it happening, but that was not considered a reason not to move ahead. There was
exactly
with the thought of this being it's the U.S. versus the Soviet Union. This is World War III we're fighting here on a different, you know, theater of war, and you know it's worth that particular risk. So now enter. By the way, Brian, welcome to the program. I should, you know,
thank you.
Man who needs no introduction around here, but still, we like to stick by the pleasantries here. Brian Wong, for those who don't know him, and anyone who listens to this program knows him very well, MrNextBigFuture.com, one of our favorite sites and frequent guest here on the program. So enter Speaker Gingrich and the footsteps that he's trying to follow in. Stephen, I think we've got a little audio soundbite of who perhaps in some ways Gingrich is trying to emulate. Can we roll that?
This is our goal. And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why 35 years ago fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
We accept the challenge. We're unwilling to postpone it. I tell you, I get every time, Stephen. We play that annually at least, and I always get a little thrill out of hearing that. Just imagining having someone in the Oval Office who could talk that way about exploring space. So I want to put it to both of you gentlemen, both in terms of what he has presented and in terms of how it's been received. How does Gingrich do in terms of walking in JFK's footsteps here?
Well, let me say first of all, I hate that speech. Just to give you a little shock, I have written essays about how stupid that argument is. When you say we do something because it is hard, well, be hard to build a tunnel from here to Australia. Let's do that. You don't do things because they're hard. You do things because they're worth doing. There's all kinds of, we could build, I wrote a thing in Fox News years ago. I said, we could build a scale replica of the Empire State Building with popsicle sticks. That would be hard. Be impossible. Let's do it. I don't buy that as an argument for doing something.
What if Rand, you changed that speech by one word, and he had said, not because it's easy, and he just dropped the second because, and he just said, not because it's easy, it's hard. And then said, because that goal will serve to organize, yada, yada, yada. I mean, does the speech come off a little better if he drops that second because?
Not to me. Because it encapsulates all the awful arguments that space advocates have been making for decades about why we should fund NASA. You know, all the spin-off crap, which we would get, you know, we'd get a lot more if you just, you know, if you're trying to do that. Obviously, there's going to be serendipity, but I do not buy it. You know, all the Tang, all the Teflon, all the, I just hate it. I hate that speech. I hate, let's do it because it's hard. I think it's just stupid. Logically, it's stupid. We need.
I think if you take it literally, I would agree. If you take it literally, it's logically stupid. I think in context, I think you're reading it a little more literally than.
But people have been reading it literally. So
I certainly
don't
hear Tang and Teflon in that speech. I hear the new frontier.
Yeah, I know, but it all gets mixed together. There's all these awful, awful arguments that people have been trying to sell space with that have been failed, the failed arguments for the last umpteen decades that I've been, you know, when I was young and dumb, I even tried those arguments, and after a while I realized, gee, these don't make any sense.
Okay, you don't like Kennedy, so... Clearly, Gingrich is doing okay. Then, do you think he's?
No, Gingrich isn't going. Gingrich is awful.
Okay.
Gingrich was Gingrich is grandiose in his own words. He thinks that's a good thing. I'm afraid that he has wrecked possibilities. Not that they were ever good, but he has wrecked the possibility of having an intelligent space discussion again for another at least few months, if not years. Because of the way he rolled out his not necessarily unreasonable policies, but he rolled them out carelessly and in a way that could be easily misinterpreted, which they were, because now people are saying, oh, well, Newt says he's going to put 13,000 people on the moon in 2020. You know, that's what they're saying. You know, he's going to have a space colony. He's going to have a lunar colony in 2020, which wasn't what he said. But in the way he said it and the things he said, you didn't have to say that. You didn't have to talk about a 51st state. You didn't have to talk about any of that crap. You know, he could have just said, we could be back on the moon in 8 years if we were doing it smarter. If we were doing it smarter than Bush, even smarter than Obama, even though Obama was better than Bush. I mean, that might have even earned some points. Who knows? I don't know what he was trying to do. He doesn't know what he's trying to do. He wings it. Every day he gets up, he doesn't plan. He is Newt.
Okay, Brian, let's. It sounds like
have I ran it enough here?
No, it's all right.
We want to get both views. What do you think, Brian? In terms of was Newt, do you think following in those footsteps, and do you think how do you think he did?
That may have been his objective, was to get some Kennedy-like echo to go for a grand vision. The problem is people like Kennedy and they don't like Newt. So that's the problem, is that lacking of charisma, that you can sell something, like Obama does it too with great speeches. You can sell plenty of good stuff, or even bad stuff, if you can, if you're a pretty person, you talk flowery and it's like salesmen. Salesmen come in and they sell you something you don't need, or sell you a more expensive car because they're better salesmen, right? So the problem is Newt's not as good a salesman as Kennedy was. So you don't buy possibly a better car, a better plan that Newt had. And I read the details of his plan, and the plan is fine. It's just that. Yeah, you added in the 13,000 people, although I also think the colonization is a good goal. But how he laid it out was something that in the current climate can easily be misinterpreted, and that was the problem. So in the Kennedy speech, I agree with Rand in that it was something I also had to get free of. Also, the mythology of Apollo and all that. And the fact that the media is all into it and create the fear of worship. That took a while for me to break free of it as well. I think that the goals and objectives of whether it's NASA, whether you make a new agency, or whether you split up NASA into its science bit and another part that it's for the propulsion aspect, I think the goal has to be make space flight cheaper, open it up. The model should be of commercializing aircraft flights for international and domestic travel. That should be the objective. Like, we've had 12 people go to the moon, 500 people, a little 500 people go to orbit, and that's just not enough. It's been 40 years. If you add up the 50 years of or so of a space program, you know, inflation adjusted, about $20 billion each year, $1 trillion. Just in the NASA part, you can triple that when you add in the military part, $3 trillion. And we have not got nearly enough. If you know, go to someone and say, we'll spend $3 trillion over the next 50 years, and we'll get 12 guys on the moon, 500 guys to orbit, and won't lower the price to go to space at all, and in some ways will go even more expensive because the space shuttle, 135 flights for, you know, $192 billion, whatever that, working out to about $1.5 billion per flight. That, you know, by measures that I see, is more expensive than the Apollo rockets, and Apollo can launch, you know, 10 times as much into low Earth orbit, can launch the weight, the cargo that the shuttle could take all the way to lunar insertion or whatever, and even the Saturn 1B could launch as much as a space shuttle. So, you know, the objectives of the space shuttle, I understand why they chose to go there, to try and go to reusability, but when they failed to do that, you know, all the reconditioning, rebuilding of in between every flight should have said, okay, that did not work. We should then cancel it. And maybe, definitely by 86, when you had the first shuttle to Aspen, you could say, okay, it's not safer, it's not cheaper, we screwed up, let's restart. But, you know, they kept going for another, you know, 24 years,
yeah,
or whatever.
Because there's so much inertia. You know, 9 years ago, we finally figured that out, but we still haven't figured out what to do next. The difference between Kennedy and Newt isn't just Kennedy versus Newt, it's also the times. When Kennedy made his speech in 1961, we were in what we perceived to be an existential race with the Soviets, and the race was with ballistic missiles and space stuff, and so he said, you know, we're going to beat them. We are not in that kind of race anymore, and, you know, Newt can't resurrect that kind of race. You can't even do it, you know, invoking the Chinese.
We can come up with compelling reasons to go to the moon, though, right? I mean, there's
yes, we can, but nobody's tried to do it, and Newt didn't do it. Newt did not come up with any reasons to do it. He just said, I want to do it.
He didn't say anything about helium-3 or anything else, did he? Did he talk about energy?
He talked about mining, but he didn't say what we're going to mine. He said why we're going to mine. He said what we're going to get. He said, I'll just lay out a vision and people just buy into it. They mocked him.
Right. There's two arguments I can see for Newt's plan. You know, I like Newt's plan of going to the moon, taking 10% of NASA's current budget and converting it into prizes. The argument I would make is the $18 billion that NASA is spending has not been doing the squat. It's going to land facilities, you know, pork projects, just like the rest of the budget, but, you know, space, we're talking about space, but, you know, the rest of the budget, same deal. It's labeled space and, you know, maybe some space research and stuff like that, but primarily the goal is to provide, you know, these PhDs, these quality jobs in different states, you know, happens to be where all the powerful senators and governors are. And that's, you know, you have this pork program with the side effect of trying to do something with space. Well, if you have a side effect of trying to do something with space and you don't even have a goal, then you're not going to do squat. They've had tried to do some other moon program before, and his way to sell his thing is, I'm going to try and do something different to achieve the lunar program. I think Bush 1 tried to go to space and stay there, which is basically a permanent moon colony. But I'm going to try and do it with these prizes. Yeah, there's a Google X Prize for $30 million to put rovers on the moon. There's the X Prize for suborbital. Those things worked. I think I want to try and expand that and see if we can and make a bigger goal happen and achievable from a portion of the budget that we're spending to do nothing, or not nothing, but, you know, like not nearly as much as we should, and try and justify it that way. That I'm taking part of, you know, one-tenth of what we're already spending to try and do a different approach, because this past approach in discussing 50 years and $1 trillion has not delivered as much as we should expect and deserve. So that would be one way to approach it. And then historically, you know, since Newton's a historian, would be to say that would be to make, and this would be a complex sell, probably wouldn't work in terms of this current political climate. It would also be mockable. But, you know, the complex sell is that the reason for colonization, if you look back at the 1600s, 1700s, when the nations were colonizing, that it wasn't the biggest nations that did it, but the ones that didn't do the colonization became the more powerful nations. They became the great naval powers. And you had to put in this long-term investment, and it, you know, paid it off for England and the other countries because they invested in it. China was a bigger country at that time, but they went into relative decline because they burned their boats and did not go. They did not colonize America. They could have. Yeah.
But China, the reason China burned the boats because they recognized that what they were doing was a vast waste of money. Because they weren't doing it for trade. They weren't doing it for to generate wealth. They're doing it for prestige. And that's the reason we continue to fail, is because, you know, the Congress continues to do a prestige. China is doing space for prestige. Nobody is doing space to make money. You know, the Ming Dynasty was not making any money, and it was smart of them, the smart of the Mandarins, to rein in, you know, that castrated general, you know, Zhang He, because he was wasting their money.
Well, so surely the point must be to
exploring, and he was coming. He was sending out vast amounts of treasure to, you know, for tribute to China and show how great China was, but there was nothing coming back.
But they were opening channels that could have provided vast wealth and power to China. China could have become the indomitable power of the world, right?
Not the way Zhang He was doing it.
So the point here is that if you're doing something for prestige and it's a big money drain, but it's a potentially extremely powerful thing, don't burn the ships. Do something useful with them, right? I mean, that's
it is. But yeah. they didn't understand that. And apparently the Congress doesn't understand that either. Well, actually, they're not even doing it for the prestige. I shouldn't say that. They are, in one part of their mind, they're saying America has to be number one in space. And in their mind, that means like having the biggest rocket or something. It's like, you know, it's phallic. But it doesn't occur to them that what we have to make economic sense. That is like the farthest thing from mind. All they care about, is America number one in space and prestige, and do we get all the jobs in the right states and districts? That's all Congress cares about, and they're the ones who provide the money. And as long as we have a government program, that's the way it's going to be. Well, we haven't really gotten to talk about a lunar colony. Did you want to do that?
Yes, we do. We actually, I want to let's spend our second half of the program getting a little deeper into that. In fact, I wanted to talk. I think Stephen and I both wanted to talk with both of you a little bit about the things you'd written on this. And Rand, you just covered point three of your piece that was over on Pajamas Media, which was that there are three aspects to look at here: the technology, the cost, and the politics. As I read your piece, the technology is potentially doable, the cost is potentially manageable, and the politics are
pretty much impossible.
Gum the thing up. All right. So let's let's put the politics aside for a moment. We will come back to it, and let's talk a little bit about the technology and the cost. Supposing that we were going to go about it smart, that there was some way to get the appropriate level of government support, if that's even what's needed, the appropriate level of incentives being put in place. Or even
just forget the politics. I mean, just the appropriate amount of economic incentives, right?
Exactly. I guess the question is, how far are we from having the technologies that would even enable us to do this? Should we choose to do it? Now, that's a pretty loaded question, because how far were we from having the technologies to get to the moon in 1961, right? But
we're a lot closer now than we were then.
Exactly. We're closer to getting to the moon. Do we really know enough to talk in terms of living there, in terms of working there? It seems that a lot of the practical economic reasons that we talk about going to the moon for are dealing with resources that we don't necessarily know how to that we haven't really done proofs of concept of, thorium or helium-3, right? It's like, that all sounds great, but that, you know, it's like we probably have some work to do before those are going to be practical realities, or even making the moon into a big solar collector, as is often discussed. Is there a practical roadmap from where we are to an economically feasible and technologically doable moon colony? I'll start with you on that one, Rand, and then Brian, we'll let you take a stab at that.
I think that, you know, we have to go back to history and say, why did people settle the New World? And they did it because they were initially they were seeking, well, it was God, gold, and glory, you know, from the terms of Columbus and the Spanish. But when the English did it, they were doing it initially for cold, hard economic reasons. They were looking for wood because they, you know, chopped down all the trees in England because they were running out of coal, or they chopped down all the trees, which is why they were going to coal, actually. But they needed, you know, just basically things like mass for ships. They needed wood, and that was a useful thing they found in the New World. And they found, you know, the Grand Bank and Cod, and there were economic resources that was worthwhile to settle North America, and so they did it. But it wasn't very long before people figured out, well, here's this new place that people can go where they can believe what they want to believe, because this is in the middle of, you know, the Hundred Years' War and the 70 Years' War and all the religious wars, where, you know, it was illegal to be a Catholic, where the Puritans were being, you know, run off to Holland, where their children, you know, weren't even, they had to bring them up and, you know, speaking a language other than English. And all of a sudden there was this new place out there where they could go. And I think, certainly not immediately, but ultimately, I think that's what's going to become attractive about off-planet resources. But in the near term, I'm struggling to think of a reason why the government, why the U.S. government, particularly this U.S. government, as it's currently constituted, would want to open up a place for people to escape. But in terms of, are we talking about sociology or technology?
No, we're talking about technology and economics, I think.
Okay, technology. We could certainly do it much cheaper than NASA does it. You know, if Elon builds a Falcon Heavy in the next couple of years, which he's claiming he will, that's going to bring prices down to $1,000 a pound. If he makes it reusable, which I hope I'll have a piece up at Popular Mechanics in the next couple of days, based on a little email interview with him I had, because he thinks he solved that problem. If he makes it reusable, that potential, that brings it down at, you know, not crazy flight rates, down to $100 a pound. And at really insanely high flight rates, down to, you know, another order of magnitude to, you know, $10 or $20 a pound to orbit, that kind of changes the game. And if you add into that propellant storage on orbit and getting water from the moon for propellant, and you've got a whole infrastructure that all of a sudden makes the whole transportation infrastructure and revolutionizes it to where it really gets affordable to send lots of stuff to the moon and back without spending anywhere near as much money as any of the estimates that people are talking about are, you know, which is like trillions of dollars for a lunar base, you know, because that's what Newt's been ridiculed for.
Right. How about what do you think, Brian? Doable. I'm gonna rephrase the question slightly, because it's obviously from reading your stuff you believe it's doable. Let's put it this way: doable. How soon? And what's the price tag?
So, using the things that Rand's already talked about, which I also had listed, but also using Bigelow Aerospace. Inflatable stations, putting that on the moon. That because Bigelow also has, besides making his inflatable space stations, which can have the volume, the next one, the BA-330, I think would have almost the volume of the International Space Station, but in inflatable form. And he wants to take those onto the moon, which with the SpaceX, if they can make those things successful, they could launch several of those and put them on the moon, and then you shovel moon dirt onto it to block radiation, or you'd land near one of the moon caves and then go inside that and come out and do whatever work in the inflatable space station. That I think the cost could be then down to on the order of three or four launches of a Falcon Heavy plus the Bigelow station. You'd be in the range of, let's, you know, let's be, not be too optimistic, but $2 billion. So you can make it happen, get crews on there, but you have to keep going. So you have to do it, keep sending your flights up there to service the crew and do stuff until they get fully independent and do other things. So let's say $2 billion per year, which is about what Newt had been talking about. And then as soon as you could do it, probably be about 2016, because you have to get your Falcon Heavy flying, you have to get your Bigelow space rated and all that kind of stuff. You want to have a few other things going. But 2016 is conceivable, and definitely the 2020 target would not be impossible. 2016 actually be, you know, actually have to be really starting, you know, right away and really moving a lot faster than we are, which we're not. So 2020 more reasonable. So I think it could definitely be achievable that way. There's other technologies that would also help. And I would also want to do more robotics on there, like to help get things processed and more things set up and safer. So you're not just landing there and requiring everything to work. You could have a robotic flight or a teleoperated flight first that would get things set up, a few things processed, get, you know, a few vats of water already, so you have, you know, redundant supply of things, so that in case things screw up, you're not hosed. So you want to have more than one facility there. I would also want to see more industrialization, so not just one moon base, but part of a wider effort to industrialize space, to get big power supplies up there, so you have power heavy equipment, and to also have some Lagrange point orbiting facilities, again, for a wider structure of support for just all in one spot and doing things. So I think that would be technology. And then another part of your question was for the technology of doing that.
No, we talked about just how long it would take and how much it would cost. I think you've actually covered both quite well. Let me ask you guys this question now, and we'll start with you this time, Brian. We're talking about the moon, but that's because that's what's been thrown into the public discourse. One of the commenters, Brian, on your blog I think it was on your blog, was talking about the moon's not really the right place to start. We should be going to the asteroids. If Robert Zubrin were on this program, he'd be talking about where the logical place to start is Mars. So I'll just throw it out to both of you. If we're going to have a permanent presence in space, do you think the moon is the right way about right way to do it? Is that where we should be going first?
No,
let me just go first, and then you can answer. I would say the moon is okay to go first. I think you could go to a near Earth object or other thing first or range point, but I think the non-space people would have tougher time with that, and the moon is okay because it has, likely discovered a lot of water there. So there are resources there, unlike before when we thought there wasn't water. So I think it's not a horrible choice that if you go there, you can do things that would be useful to get things going. And if things happen with the Falcon Heavy, where you get costs down to $1,000 per pound or under 100 to 10, then once things get cheap, you don't have to be optimizing everything. You don't have to be saying, oh, what can I choose this, door number one or number two or the box, because I only have one shot. I have to spend so many tens of billions of dollars to do something. Once the costs go way, way down, I have to choose. Just like right now, I don't have to choose, okay, do I go to Disneyland or to Knott's Berry Farm. I can only go once in my lifetime for over the next 10 years. I can't screw up. I got to make the right choice. If things go way down, then I don't have to be agonizing over what to go to. I can just go to a bunch of things and go to them all.
Right, right. Although given that choice, I think you got to go to Disneyland, I would say.
Or Disney World,
me.
Though, actually.
Well, that was not on the list, Ren. So you were going to tell us
definitely not the right place to start. Not
optimally,
Paris,
where would you get this going?
Well, I would get it going in cislunar space. I mean, the first thing to do is establish some waypoints at the Lagrange points, and get some logistics going, and make it possible so that we can go to the moon or to anywhere. And that's what just so frustrates me, that people are so focused on destinations and they don't care about how do we build a transportation infrastructure. We need places where we can stop and fuel and store fuel, because if you can't store fuel, you can't have reusable vehicles. If you can't have reusable vehicles, you can't have affordable transportation. And it just drives me nuts that NASA and the Congress insist on doing Apollo again, saying that we have to do everything in a single launch and throw everything away, because that is the inevitable idea of why you need a 100-ton vehicle or 130-ton vehicle or 70-ton vehicle or whatever arbitrary number they pull out of some part of their anatomies. Without any basis for it, without any published studies, without anything to justify why they have to build this vehicle this particular size, when instead they have to figure out how do we do. And here's to me the crushing argument: if you think that we need a vehicle that can carry 130 tons to orbit in order to do space exploration, why don't you need two? Because why do you want to be in a position where you, if that vehicle goes down and you really believe that you're smart enough now, this time you're going to have something that doesn't have a problem, that it's not going to go down for 2 or 3 years like the shuttle did twice?
Right.
Why don't
you
need two?
Even with the space station, right, it was nice there for a while when we had either the shuttle or the Russians, right? We had two different possible ways of doing that. It seems like that's just a logical approach to doing anything. But
now we have one. We have the Russians who just delayed their next launch because they have a leak in they had a total Soyuz capsule that couldn't hold air.
Right. Yeah, when you're down to one, your one better work. That's for sure. But
yeah.
I
if you're willing to be down to one that says you don't think it's that important, there's other things. There's clearly other things that are driving your decisions and whether or not it's important to be able to do this.
Well, one of the things that seems to be emerging that I find most exciting is that there do seem to be multiple models now coming from the private sector for how we can get into space. And Brian, to your point, there are multiple choices as to where we go and how we start on this. I would respond to the idea that people, you know, it's frustrating that people get caught up on destinations, but I understand why they do. Speaking as a marketing person here, just for a minute, that, you know, destinations are exciting, they're intriguing, they're mysterious, they're, you know, evocative of all these emotions that make us want to go to someplace, you know, and frankly, the words transportation infrastructure just don't give you that.
Okay,
same,
but why isn't saying we can go everywhere?
Yeah.
Instead of we can go to Mars or we can go to the moon. Why isn't we can go anywhere in the solar system? Why isn't that more exciting than Mars or moon?
That sounds great to me. And
go ahead,
I have a point about another way to pick destinations would be to and building infrastructure. To agree with that is. Before colonization, I'm obviously totally for colonization and believe that's the ultimate goal, is I have three things that I think can make good money. Not the mining aspect, although you certainly want to get water for fuel, but that's for resources for your in-space operations, for your industry. Taking it back to Earth doesn't make sense if we're not running out of stuff. So the three things that I think of are tourism, because there people spend $70,000 to $100,000 to climb Everest. 4,000 people have tried. The summit costs $200,000. 1,000 people go mountaineering, not just Everest, other places, ocean expeditions. You know, your Branson types going to ocean expeditions, mountaineering. So there's adventure tourism is a big thing. And if you say, okay, you know, Romney's a VC buddy. You know, you went to climb Everest. You know, the other guy, he's gone to the moon or orbit. You know, who's gone twice to orbit, can brag to all his multimillionaire friends he's gone to those places. So the high-end tourism, extreme tourism, is, I think, a multi-billion-dollar market, at least $1 billion. International tourism is $919 billion in 2010. So this is a pretty big market. As you bring the price down from the current $20 million to go to orbit down to $5,000, and then less, that market will grow.
And I would add that, you know, 10% of the people who try Everest die.
Right. Yeah, 1 in 10%, 1 in 6, something like that.
I mean, that's worth pointing out, you know, when we talk about safety and how much money we should spend on safety.
And the other two industries are information and satellite servicing. The global satellite industry revenue was $168 billion. So if you spend 5% of that to service or 5-10% to enhance what's going on there with enhanced services, with more developed capabilities, that's a market, an existing market. And then the last one I thought of was the entertainment that has had IMAX movies on the shuttles. Those have made, you know, $50 million in seats. And you have bigger movies, better movies. You often need someone like James Cameron, who made Titanic, to help do those kind of things. And then also something that tied in with theme parks, video games, that the entertainment industry of movies, theme parks, video games, I think that totals up to perhaps $50 billion or $70 billion, you know, probably even more worldwide. And that you could find ways to leverage space to make unique entertainment experiences, live entertainment experiences where you're teleoperating stuff for real. I think there's ways to make that entertaining. And then once you have the infrastructure for that, once you have your space hotels up there, then you have the service staff up there, and then you're starting to get on the way to colonization, that you're going to have the towns and stuff to do things. And so then backing into locations, where to go, you know, you would let the tourist markets start telling you, well, where did they want to go? Do they want to go to orbit? Do they want to go to the moon? Do they want to go to asteroids? The Satellite Information Servicing might have some destination entertainment, might have some servicing. If you have, you know, if you spent $300 million on Avatar 1, then maybe this is a good movie for, and you made $2 million or $1 billion on your Apollo 13 movie, you know, there could be some, you know, with the right filmmakers and the right entertainment thing, some very profitable moon entertainment, moon missions and Mars missions.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess that gets back to my point. It's just, I don't understand why being able to go anywhere, you know, because Heinlein said, you know, once you're in low Earth orbit, you're halfway to anywhere. Why isn't that a more appealing vision than Mars or Moon or whatever? I just don't get it. I mean, that's what's been driving me crazy for the last 2 years after the Obama administration came out with the one good policy the Obama administration came out with, which is we're going to, you know, open up to anywhere. We're going to have a flexible path to go anywhere. And everybody said, oh, well, we abandoned the moon. Well, bullshit. We didn't abandon the moon. We just made it easier to get to the moon and all the other places, too.
Right. Yeah. I think the idea of going anywhere is absolutely compelling, but people have to get clear on the idea that that's what you're talking about. You're talking about opening up all the places that they're thinking about, plus a lot of them that they're not thinking about.
And the administration they had a great policy, and their articulation of it was awful and it remains awful, and it's never been good. They have not improved. They just, because they don't really care about space. They just happened to put a couple people in charge who did care about space, and so they rolled over. They had a good policy, but they're so incompetent. The White House is so incompetent that they didn't coordinate with the Congress. Didn't try to say here's what we're doing. Didn't try to say you know didn't do any dealing or wheeling or whatever to say you know this is what we want change in this direction. They just announced it, you know, point blank 2 years ago, and then they got blasted for it. And it fed in all of the anti-Obama hatred from the Republicans, much of which is justified, in my opinion. But you know, space policy was a collateral damage in that. So just let the porkers take over.
It does feel like with the way the political dynamics work these days, the way political rhetoric works, and the kind of winner take all and vilification that goes on, space is going to lose every time somebody takes it, somebody promotes it, as you see demonstrated here with Newt, because
it's
that immediately
important.
Puts whoever's opposed to them politically opposed to space as well, right?
Because space is not important.
Yeah.
And, you know, space was politically important for a small moment, a few years, you know, 40-some years ago. Hasn't been since, and that's why it's a mess. You know, Johnson decided to make it a Marshall Plan for the South, and so it became a jobs program, and that's where it's been ever since, and that is a really, really tough. I mean, I just wrote a piece about this in Reason magazine, and I recommend people go to reason.com and look up the February 2012 edition, just to kind of, if they want to get a kind of a history, brief history on this and why it's a mess. But it's
check
a
it
mess.
Out. Get some background on it. Go ahead.
Yeah, Rand, I would absolutely agree that you know, we do need to do it different from Apollo, whatever it is we do. And, you know, a multitude of approaches to get into space, you know, things like the Dark Sky Station where they, you know, you have basically balloons getting halfway to orbit.
Halfway to orbit.
Yeah, halfway to space. And then from there, what you're trying to do, obviously, is get there as cheaply as possible. And that might be one approach. Of course, SpaceX is working hard to to have their own heavy lifters and everything, which is sort of a more traditional approach.
But the point is, here, the way to get costs down is to have competition. Is have actual competition, market, and people who want to get into space and have competition to drive down the cost of getting into space. And
right.
We have never, ever had that until the last few years, and NASA's has still been fighting, and Congress has been fighting even harder because they don't want the cost of going to space to get down. They just want jobs.
So basically, once you have two companies that are both on the moon making money and competing with each other, then problem
then
solved.
The prices,
right?
The problem's solved.
Yeah.
Well, you don't even have to go to the moon. I mean, once you have people going to orbit, you know, making money, competing with each other, the problem's solved.
Yeah,
there's been so much government involvement for the last 50 years. You know, we're just starting now. SpaceX is kind of breaking the ice on that. And you know, the Chinese, who are subsidizing their launch vehicles, say, we don't know how to compete with SpaceX.
Good.
Although one thing would be that I think that if SpaceX succeeds, and I definitely do want them to succeed, even though we don't really see any strong competitor currently, I think the competition, at least from other countries, even though China says we have trouble competing, they will try as hard as possible to compete, because if SpaceX has several reusable Falcon Heavies flying regularly up to space, the amount of domination in terms of control space that the U.S. via SpaceX will have, the other countries won't let that stand, because that means the U.S. can say which satellites stay flying if there was a conflict, that they would then control all that space. Just like the strongest Navy, if you control the islands and stuff, you control the surrounding waters. If you have the strongest rocket fleet and reusable and all that, then you control near Earth orbit, you control the area between the Earth and the Moon and all that kind of stuff. And so China and Russia and Europe and all the other countries would then have to step up and say, we have to develop our own SpaceX, even if it costs us a bunch more, until we get it right, because we can't just let the U.S. have it. So then we have a space race and then drive the cost down and all that other stuff because of the political aspects, the military aspects, and all that other stuff. And also the commercial.
Okay, but remember, this is a private company that's doing this. It's not a U.S. government thing. So it's a new world in terms of space. Because up till now, it's been governments against governments. Once it's a private entity that's beating the pants of all these government agencies, that's a new world.
It's an interesting scenario. It seems to me that having private players involved is a game changer. Potentially, it's a big disruptor. As is the fact that we might be opening up a new frontier, Brian, to your point, via tourism and entertainment. That's certainly not how new frontiers have been opened up in the past. Gentlemen, we are completely out of time. I had a couple more questions that I wanted to try to slip in, but we're just going to have to pick it up some other week. I just want to say very quickly thank you both for being with us, and let's pick this discussion up at some point in the future.
Okay. Don't know if we talk about moon bases that much, but it was probably an interesting discussion in the context of the times.
Excellent.
All right, Stephen, what's our music this evening?
All right, our music this evening is kind of a funny song, Snooter by Josh Woodward. You ever notice that dogs love you no matter how big of a jerk you are? This is kind of a song about that. So
a song for Newt. There it is, Snooter. Snooter the dog.
We dedicate this song to Newt.
Newt Gingrich. Thanks for putting that together. Thanks again to our guests, for everyone listening. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back again next week at our regular time. And until then, live to see it.